Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott. As you know, this is our regimen, everyone. We begin every single damn show with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman when he testified before the impeachment hearings in 2019. At that moment, I was just so impressed with his courage. I was so impressed with his love of country. I realized I needed to celebrate what he did. And of course, when he was practically perp walk out with his twin brother in February of 2020, I needed to make sure that we kept that powerful testimony in our heads as we enter the 2020 election in November. I'm going to remind you, as you hear it every day, the powerful voice of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
We open our show with an interview from Kaiser Health News. I love Kaiser Health News. I found it about 2 or 3 years ago. I've used Stat News, Kaiser Health News, MedPage Today. I'm just curious about health anyway. And then, of course, now with the pandemic, how could you not be curious about health? I saw an article that was entitled, "The Hidden Deaths of the COVID Pandemic." Markian Haralup is joining us. He is the author of this piece. Now, Markian, explain to us a little bit about your relationship with Kaiser Health News. You are based in Colorado, my understanding is. Tell my audience a little bit about your history and why being based in Colorado is actually sort of pivotal for the kind of news that you cover for Kaiser Health.
Yeah, thanks, Arnie. Thanks for having me on your show. Yeah, so Kaiser Health News is a nonprofit independent health news agency. We're not affiliated with Kaiser Permanente in any way, which you always have to give that disclaimer.
I have to say that.
We do. Yeah. Kaiser Health News is about 10 years old, and they have a large presence in D.C., also in California. And over the years, they've hired some of the best health reporters around to produce copy that that any publication can pick up for free and run. So we're completely independent, and we're not beholden to advertisers. We're not beholden to clicks. We don't have a page to fill. So we can really focus just on getting the healthcare story exactly right. And last year, we started an expansion. We put a bureau in St. Louis, three people in St. Louis, three great reporters there. And we expanded into Colorado, first presence in the Rocky Mountain region. And they hired me to come and fill that Denver bureau position. We are now actually expanding in the Rocky Mountain areas, and we're getting a presence up in Montana. We're going to hire a second reporter here in Colorado. And it was just a region where there were so many untold healthcare stories. And we see many newspapers now having to cut back, and there are fewer and fewer dedicated healthcare reporters. So Kaiser Health News is really trying to fill that gap, that knowledge gap, and make sure people kind of understand how healthcare is impacting them in their lives.
Well, again, you know, who would have thunk that just before you got hired that, you know, within 2020, we would be suffering one of the most incredible healthcare crises, not only in the United States, but on the planet. So Your timing is perfect. The reason why I grabbed this story, The Hidden Deaths of the COVID Pandemic, is that I have been holding the hand of a friend. And my friend is in her early 70s. She discovered that she had breast cancer. Now, this is right about the time we're just beginning to see conversations about COVID-19, but it really hadn't sort of entered the lexicon in the United States. So she, you know, she has the operation, she has radiation, and then whoops, they forgot to do the chemo. Right? All right, right, right. So she's really upset, and I get her a second opinion about whether she actually needs the chemo or not. And it turns out that the guy that I get her to have the second opinion is one of the top breast cancer people in the world. And he's based where? At Mass General. And there's an experiment on her kind of cancer for her age group in everything. And it's a special, special sort of small group of women who were diagnosed, and they were going to set up, you know, this kind of opportunity to be treated. So she says, I think I'm going to do it. Right as she says, I think I'm going to do it, is when it gets crazy in Massachusetts, because Massachusetts, like New York, becomes sort of an epicenter for what's going on with COVID-19. And of course, Mass General gets slammed. And then the conversation is, do you continue to go down to Mass General to get the chemo? Who's going to drive you? Where are they going to sit? He keeps telling you that they will be separate from the hospital. But from what I can tell at this point, I'm not sure if anything is separate from the hospital on COVID-19. And the question becomes, you're going to be more vulnerable as a result of the chemo. And you're in the age group where this is a demographic that is easily targeted by COVID-19, not just for getting it, but for dying from it. So we have these incredibly long, intensive conversations. Fast forward, she quit. She's not getting the chemo. She's not getting the treatment. Now, she is not the hidden death of COVID-19, not yet, but she might be, because it might come back, and it might have given her an extra 5 or 10 years. But the decision not to continue with this phenomenal doctor in this remarkable trial was an amazing opportunity, but she had to walk away because the fear was worse about contracting COVID and dying than actually the fear of, well, I might then get 5 years cut off from my life or 10 years because I know now that I'm even more vulnerable. So with that as sort of laying at your feet, now you understand why the story is both personal for me, but important for my radio audience.
Yeah, it's a very poignant tale, Arnie. And, you know, we early in this epidemic, we started talking about, you know, these, we might face this decision where we don't have enough ventilators and we're going to have to make this gut-wrenching choice of whether to put patient A on a ventilator or patient B on a ventilator. And how do you make that decision? Well, what's turned out is as your example shows, a lot of people are making that same decision with respect to themselves. Do I put myself at risk by going into the hospital and potentially exposing myself to a COVID-19 infection? Or do I put myself at risk by not going into the hospital and allowing my chronic condition, my ailment, my physical problem to get worse and potentially have a worse outcome than had I been infected with COVID. And so these kinds of stories are playing out all across the country right now.
You start with such an emotional story because, again, I have another friend who's, you know, a social worker and she's got a master's in public health. At one point, the unit that she was in, every single person who works within the community came down with COVID-19, every single person in her unit, okay? But that meant that, one, they had to isolate, but that meant they weren't serving their social work clients as effectively as they had been before. And of course, the reason why they're serving them is that they're mentally ill, they have drug addiction, they have everything else. And so she knows that the cause of her COVID might have been one of her clients, but the reality is now she can't serve her clients. So tell the story that you begin with, because it is so poignant and emotional, and it would probably not necessarily be in the COVID-19 box, but does it deserve to be there when you say COVID-19 and the number of deaths?
Yeah. So the woman that I wrote about was Sarah Whitner. She was, you know, a young woman, 32, comes from a wonderful family in a suburb of Denver here. A lovely person, very talented. She had a beautiful singing voice. When she was younger, she had some surgery, was prescribed pain pills afterwards and became addicted to them. And she struggled with this addiction over the years, but you know, her family helped her get into rehab. She got past it. She was doing well for a while, engaged to be married. Then in December, she had a relapse. And so, you know, again, the family kind of rallied around her, helped her get into a 30-day detox program. And at the end of that program, she decided to start taking a monthly injection that would block her opiate cravings. It's a medication called Vivitrol. it was a great choice because she was engaged to be married. She wanted to start a family, and she felt like this would give her the best chance of getting pregnant without, you know, having any sort of problems related to her medication. And it was working for her. She had had her first monthly shot. She had her second monthly shot. She was doing well. She was working full time. And then the COVID pandemic hit. When the pandemic hit, it just kind of knocked out all those supports that she had built around her. She moved back in with her family because, everybody was sort of quarantined. So, in the midst of the lockdown, she's living with her parents, her sister. They had a whole zoo of animals in the house. The parents have adopted 5 small kids. And so, you know, it's a little bit chaotic, but, you know, it's a great family, and it was a wonderful place for her to be. But with the COVID pandemic, clinics started to, you know, shut down or to pull back. They ended up delaying her appointment for her next monthly injection. So instead of getting it on the 30-day schedule, they pushed her back another 2 weeks to 45 days. And about a week after her original appointment, so she was about 37 days out from her shot, on Easter Sunday, April 12th, she started using again, unbeknownst to her parents and her family. They only kind of figured this out later, like kind of looking through her phone, figuring out like her text messages. They could sort of recreate when everything happened. She used it again on following Tuesday and on Wednesday. And her appointment was on Friday. Thursday morning, her sister was, you know, it was around 9 o'clock in the morning. And her sister thought, gosh, you know, Sarah hasn't gotten up yet. She's really sleeping in late. That's not like her. I'm going to go check on her. And she opens the door to her bedroom and she sees Sarah lying in bed, kind of on her side. And she sees that the blood has sort of pooled on one side of her body. There's some froth on her lips and she's still clutching a syringe in her hand. Grace, her sister, called out for her father. Father ran in. They called 911. He started doing CPR on her. You know, within a few minutes, the paramedics arrived in full hazmat suits because it's the height of the COVID pandemic, but it's too late. They can't save Sarah. So in talking with the family, you know, I asked them, do you think this is a COVID death? And the father said, yes, absolutely it is. I mean, surely she died from an overdose. She probably got something laced with fentanyl. But from her family's perspective, it was COVID that killed her because it was COVID that prevented her from getting her shot on time. It was COVID that delayed all of the Narcotics Anonymous meetings that she was going to. They'd switched to Zoom calls versus an inpatient thing, and that just doesn't work for every patient. She couldn't meet with her support system, her NA sponsor, or the friends that she would, you know, sit down over coffee and talk to about what she was going through, and so they could support one another. The father, Leon Whitner, he had these very poignant words about how, you know, people in Sarah's positions, they live on the razor's edge, and it doesn't take much for them to get pushed off one side or the other. And that's what happened to Sarah. The COVID pandemic clearly influenced what happened to her life. And she might still be with us if not for the circumstances surrounding this virus.
So why are we having this conversation? Because you have a sort of a paragraph entitled, How to Count. And that's what this is about, everyone. In the U.S., I'm going to quote from your article, which is fabulous, by the way. In the U.S., COVID-19 is a, quote, notifiable disease. That means doctors, coroners, hospitals, and nursing homes must report when encountering someone who tests positive for the infection and when a person who is known to have the virus dies. That provides a nearly real-time surveillance system for health officials to gauge where and to what extent outbreaks are happening. But it's a system designed for speed over accuracy. It will invariably include deaths maybe not caused by the virus, as well as missed deaths that were. Now, as I was reading it, I kept thinking, we do interview a fellow who covers all the unions in New York, and he covers a lot of the EMTs and the firefighters, and he was talking about, you know, the number of calls that they were getting during the height of the pandemic in New York. They were getting usually 30 people dying, you know, and up to like 130 people dying. They were getting, you know, and he said, so the question is that extra 100 dying because they died of COVID-19 and never got to a hospital? Are those extra 100 dying because they had a heart attack because they didn't have treatment for their heart conditions because they're afraid to go to a hospital. Again, is that a COVID-related death? This count number is so fraught with politics, good healthcare understanding, with understanding the social, emotional, and mental consequences of COVID-19. And I guess the challenge is going to be, how are we going to define this marketing? How are you going to be able to finally step back and say, I can pretty much suggest that there are probably twice the number of deaths, I'm making that number up, but the reason why they're not going to be counted is they don't fit into this nice little black and white box. But yet, if it weren't for COVID, they probably would still have a pulse and they'd still be alive.
Right, Arnie. And, you know, we've got actually a really, really sophisticated way of tracking deaths over time. And we've done this for 100 years. Every county just adds up all the deaths we have from different causes of death. And so we can predict with fairly good accuracy how many people should die of a heart attack in New York City this year, how many people should have cancer in Boston. All of these different conditions, we know with statistical validity what that expected death should be within, you know, some certain margin of error. So when we look back at the total number of deaths and, you know, taking New York City, for example, there was a 6-week period in New York City where the number of excess deaths was something like, 30,000, 30,000 people. We know that's not going to happen by chance. It's, you know, there's got to be something else going on to kill that many more people. And the only logical explanation right now is this COVID pandemic. If there was something else, we would have recognized it by now. What that excess death number gives us is it gets us beyond the problem we have that we're not testing enough. We don't have the resources. We don't have the capacity to test everyone and know exactly who's got COVID and who doesn't have COVID. So the excess death number tells us, first of all those people who have COVID and are dying at home without ever getting tested. You know, this might be somebody who had a heart attack at home. You know,
It might be a lot of undocumented immigrants who are feared going to the hospital. Look at places like Chelsea. Look at places like Houston, where these people are just, they're frightened to death. They don't have a support system. They don't have access to Medicaid. And as a result, not only do they stay home and die without letting anyone know, but think about the people they're infecting. I mean, you're absolutely right. The numbers are so loosey-goosey at this point in time because there's so many fear factors about contracting COVID or going into some sort of a public setting, but it also has other consequences.
Right. And even that, you know, it doesn't even have to be an undocumented, you know, immigrant. It can be, you know, my father, your brother who is, you know, at home and having symptoms of a heart attack, but thinking, maybe I'll just wait this out because I'm scared. If I go to the emergency room, I'll pick up COVID. And hospitals have actually been, you know, starting these public relation campaigns, say, hey, please come to the hospital. We can keep you safe. We will divide you away from the COVID patients. If you have a condition that in the past would bring you to the emergency room, you should still go to the emergency room. So and the other thing that we get in the excess death number is sort of these indirect deaths, like Sarah Whitner's, like the friend that you mentioned.
Hasn't died, but we know that her life expectancy probably has changed.
Exactly. Yeah. And they never contracted the virus. It isn't an infection that killed them or led to their death, but the virus has altered the way we provide healthcare in this country. The circumstances around the pandemic have their sort of indirect deaths. And as you know, I said in the story, we went through this with Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico a couple of years ago, where, you know, initially the storm hit, the people that were directly killed by the storm was something in the range of, you know, 64 people, something of that sort. But over time, Puerto Rico had so many more excess deaths because of what Hurricane Maria did to the healthcare system and the poor response to that, to, you know, our inability or our desire to you know, overlook the needs that Puerto Rico had in requiring more help to save people.
I'm going to make a recommendation, Mark. Who am I to make a recommendation to the Kaiser Health News? But again, we're, the article we're talking about is the hidden deaths of the COVID pandemic. And as I'm listening to you talk, I see concentric rings. I see the circle in the middle being people we absolutely know tested positive for COVID-19, Maybe you're on a ventilator, the ventilator's pulled off, they're dead, or whatever. We know COVID-19. And then there are people that we suspect, or we know they had COVID. I mean, and with each, it gets bigger and bigger and a little more diffuse. But what we definitely know is, but for COVID, this person probably would not have died of the heart attack. And the other problem with COVID is, you may now survive COVID. And what we're finding out, unlike the flu, is that you might have a permanent heart condition. You might have a permanent liver condition. So it's one of the reasons why we do this. It also means that we have to have a new sort of come to Jesus conversation about healthcare in this country. Because really what you're pointing to is that even when the pandemic is over, it's not. Because of all these other consequences that weren't directly related to contracting COVID, but COVID has changed the healthcare landscape in America.
You're absolutely right, Arnie. And we're going to see a long tail from this COVID pandemic, even once we get the virus under control. Maybe we've got a vaccine, maybe we've got good treatments, maybe people are no longer going to be dying of COVID. We're still going to have all these people, A, who had COVID and were damaged by COVID, you know, who have breathing problems for the rest of their life because of their illness. We also have all of the circumstances around people who didn't seek the normal care for their chronic conditions. The diabetics whose, you know, blood sugar has gotten out of control because they haven't been going in for their appointments. The high blood pressure that's not being measured and treated. The cancer screenings that aren't getting done, and so cancers aren't being diagnosed and treated quickly. All of these things are going to have this long tail that we're going to have to address. And you know, you mentioned kind of about the healthcare system. COVID has really helped to elucidate the weaknesses of our healthcare system design right now. I mean, we see this with even the financing of healthcare. You know, the combination of the pandemic and the economic crisis has left so many people without healthcare insurance. And some states are doing better than others at getting these people onto Medicaid because they've expanded Medicaid. Other states haven't done that. They don't have that option right now. So we're going to start to, at some point, look back at COVID and say, what are the lessons we learned? And we know another pandemic is going to come. You know, it may be, you know, another 100 years. It may not be in my lifetime or your lifetime, Arnie, but another one is going to come.
Excuse me, there's going to be a variation, because what you pointed to in your wonderful piece, everyone, Kaiser Health News, go, the hidden deaths of the COVID pandemic, it'll be put up on my Facebook page. Plus, we'll post it in other places. But, Mark, as I was thinking about this, you point to the hurricane in Puerto Rico. That wasn't a pandemic. But, you know, after different groups kept going down and looking at the consequences of what happened in Puerto Rico, the number went from, you know, 64 to a couple of thousand, to a couple more thousand, to a couple more thousand. Here's my last question to you. My concern here is this, is that numbers are powerful things. And I want people to do the math. But for this country, and for probably most countries, numbers are political, okay? Because you don't always want to have a come-to-Jesus moment and know the real number. You know, it's maybe to your advantage to have the number smaller. It may be to your advantage to have the number bigger. And for example, right now we know you can get free testing if you don't have health insurance. And people are saying, well, then, you know, if you go into the hospital, even if you have free testing and you don't have health insurance, we'll cover you for COVID. Well, what happens if I end up with a permanent heart condition? Are you going to cover that permanent heart condition in perpetuity because it was related to the COVID that you said I could be tested free with and that you said I could be treated for? Well, if the COVID treatment turns out that I survived, but I survived with a condition that I didn't have before COVID, do you follow the condition because it's got a nexus to COVID? I mean, this is such an important policy question that as you do this, it is about the count. But I think people need to understand that there is politics in the count as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, we saw that after Hurricane Maria, and, you know, the FEMA even went to the point of creating this work group to say, how do we best tally the death toll from a natural disaster? And they're going to use those same guidelines once they come out in July to tally the death toll from this COVID pandemic. But I'll spin what you said forward a little bit. Think about this. A lot of people are going to end up with a pre-existing condition because of COVID-19. And we're right in the middle of this legal challenge to the ACA, which would undermine the pre-existing condition protections we have in this country.
Now, because of this COVID, I mean, the likelihood is 99.9% of us are going to have a pre-existing condition. And I'm going to give you an example. And you might want to write an article about this at Kaiser Health. I always give people assignments. I cover Texas and New Hampshire a lot, okay? And in Texas, you can't vote absentee because the fear of contracting COVID is not a disability, according to Governor Abbott. Yeah. In the state of New Hampshire, the fear of contracting COVID is a disability in the state of New Hampshire. So two different states, both Republican governors, one who's less fearful of losing his seat, the other one very fearful of losing his seat. And my governor has said, oh, fear of contracting COVID is a disability. Well, if it's a disability, what does that mean? Is it only a disability for the purposes of voting? Or can I now call it a disability for the purposes of gaining access to some kind of expanded healthcare or SSI or whatever? I mean, again, it's so interesting because now we're trying to thread this political needle, but we're using this disease as the excuse to either do something or recognize something or not. So there are a lot of stories about, is COVID-19 and the fear of contracting it, is it a disability, and what does that mean? Yeah. So on that note, Marky, you are fabulous. You are coming back. Thank you so much for doing this. It makes us more aware of this. I really do see it as a concentric rings. And I think we need to understand that this ring is getting bigger and bigger. And almost at some point, I feel like we're all going to tumble into a ring, because this pandemic is not just in the United States, it's universal. Thank you so much for writing for Kaiser Health News.
Thank you, Arnie. Thanks for having me on your show. It's been a blast.
All right. Marky Haraluk is a reporter for Kaiser Health News based in Colorado. We will get him back. All right, everyone, stick around. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins.
Leaky Lavatories on this current cast. Would you flush hundreds of gallons of unused water down the drain each day? Probably not. But if you have a leaky toilet, you could be wasting that much without knowing it. Karen Worth of the Environmental Protection Agency's WaterSense program explains how to check your toilet for leaks.
If you have a tank-type toilet, place a few drops of food coloring in the tank. If that color shows up in the bowl within like 15 seconds without flushing it, that's a sure sign that you have a leak in your toilet.
The most common cause is a worn-out flapper, which is easy and inexpensive to fix. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Scars, they don't see the angel living in your heart.
Welcome back to part two of the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and, of course, our great producers, Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. I saw a piece at the Washington Post. It's under a section called The Monkey Church. It looks at issues because I think we all kind of feel like we're, what's the great quote from the monkey cage? It's the idea that somehow the person that's running the circus is actually the one that's living in the monkey cage. And to a large extent, that means you're covering things that people maybe won't be looking at because they're looking at a title. They may not be looking at what's in the cage of actually manipulating the outcome. Matthew Nelson is joining us. He wrote a piece at the Washington Post entitled, America's Classrooms Shut Down This Spring. Civics Lessons Shifted to the Streets. And if you could see my smile, you would know that I totally agree with him. Let me just tell you that Matt Nelson is a PhD candidate in the Department of Political Science at Northwestern University. He is actually defending his dissertation tomorrow, the day the show airs. So it's good luck for you because we Zoomed the day before. Let me share a story with you that will then segue into the Washington Post piece that you wrote. I used to teach mass communications way back when, in the late 1990s. I was always trying to explain to my audience and my students that, you know, different newspapers had different political slants. But sometimes, even with what you thought was, quote, the generic news, it actually wasn't the same depending on the political slant of the paper. So I would go to the Washington Post and the Washington Times. In my state, I would go to the Concord Monitor and the very infamous Union Leader. So it's kind of, you know, it's like the Daily News versus, you know, that kind of thing. And so I would pick up an AP story, okay, a generic AP story. And then I said, okay, here are the four papers. I want, and this is before we have the internet, this is before social media, so we actually had to have the freaking papers in front of us. I want you to take this story and I want you to find it in these four papers because I know that they're in there. And so they would look at these four papers and they would be shocked. And what they would find is one paper would put the story on the front page. The other paper would put it on the obituary page. One paper would have a very provocative headline. The other one would have a very sort of meaty, content-driven headline. One paper would rearrange the paragraphs and start with paragraph two and not paragraph one. Another paper would edit it out and the whole conclusion would be gone. Same exact AP story. And I had them read it through the lens of knowing what the political bias was of the paper. Yes, they were getting technically on paper the same news. But what you did when you walked away from that news story was get a very different visceral, emotional, and knowledge result. Having said that, let's talk about your article, because your article just like a light bulb moment for me, because you kind of have done a variation on that theme with some students in Detroit, I believe it was, or Chicago. At the same time, you're also looking at what's happened as a result of the shutdown, because what we've seen is a lot of young people now participating in these protests. Yes, it's to get out, but it's turning out that they're getting out and they're also learning.
That's right. So in the United States, we've always struggled to ensure that young people have access to quality civic education courses. The apex of civic education in the United States was in the 1960s and 1970s, when most high school students were receiving 2 to 3 civics or American government courses. However, when looking at this history, it's important to acknowledge that when, you know, Jefferson and Washington were talking about ensuring civic education for young people in the United States, they were not talking about ensuring civic learning opportunities for immigrants, for women, and for people of color. After all, these are the same individuals who built institutions that reserved political processes for white men. So
property owner, Protestant white men. Let's just make sure we even narrow it even more, but keep going.
Correct. So even though there have been these moments throughout United States history where there's been a lot of interest about civic education, it hasn't necessarily represented the stories or the agency of marginalized groups. You know, fast forward to 2020, in addition to, you know, still struggling to ensure that young people have the space to learn about government, to learn about political processes, I would argue that the content of these courses is still insufficient to empower young people, and particularly young people of color, simply because of the narratives that we tell time and time again. We tend to focus on, individuals who were able to access these high positions of power. So for example, presidents of the United States. So what I'm really interested in my research is, what if we invert that story a bit? And we talk about the ways in which individuals marginalized by political processes still exercise agency and win. And my research demonstrates that these experiences, these civic learning experiences, are extremely empowering for young people of color. And the recent wave of protests just demonstrates this. So in addition to struggling to reserve the space for civic education, now we have a context in which schools have closed. So all of a sudden it is organizers, it's community activists who are taking on the role of civic educators by, one, demonstrating that collective action, that protests can yield very tangible political outcomes, as we're seeing, you know, in cities like Minneapolis, where elected officials are publicly stating that they are committed to defunding the police. But also, these organizers are pushing participants in the protests to reflect upon the historical roots of anti-Black violence in the United States. So it's not simply that young people are coming out to the streets for the first time to participate. They're actually learning about the historic roots of this movement, which is incredibly empowering. And again, that's exactly the theme that comes out of my research as well.
It's a teachable moment on every level. I come from New York. My parents were New York City school teachers. My father was a teacher of the year. My father was a history teacher. He didn't realize when he taught me to question authority, I would question him. But one of the things that was so fabulous about your article is that one of the frustrations I have is that, so my father did teach in the 60s and 70s. He did have current events tests. He did have them read newspapers. He did have them watch Walter Cronkite. He did have them. So they had to produce. But of course, again, as you point out, who is writing the textbooks? Who are writing the newspapers? What stories were they telling? What stories weren't they telling? So yes, he was reinforcing, but he was also reinforcing the norms of the time. And the norms of the time made sure that stories of African Americans, stories of Native Americans, they weren't part of the subject matter, and reporters didn't cover it either. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, they might have covered something a little bit because of the civil rights movement, and there'd be this blip, but there wasn't this real pattern and practice because we hadn't developed that muscle. What I think is so exciting about today is that what you point out about the shutdown and the civics lessons in the street is that if young people start participating now, they'll participate for the rest of their life. Because this is a muscle that you acquire. And the earlier you acquire it, the stronger it gets and the more resilient it gets. So you make a connection here. And that you said that these organizers don't just want to teach about George Floyd. Because if it does teach about George Floyd, then it seems like, oh, it's just a mistake now. And what they are using this is an opportunity to go back 50 years ago, go back 100 years ago, and to sort of do this drumbeat of knowledge and information and pattern, and talk about lynchings, you know, and talk about the gap between rich and poor, and talk about the fact that, you know, there's a wonderful book called The Color of Law, you know, that by policy, we actually disinvested from the African-American community. It looked generic on its face, but the consequence was not that in any way. And so this is a wonderful opportunity. Tell them the story about the 700 students that you worked with and what happened when you gave them the exact same sort of time period in history to study, but you gave them two different places to learn that history. I love you for this. So explain to my audience what you did.
That's right. So during the 2017 and 2018 academic year, I went into 9 Chicago area high schools. I selected these high schools based on racial and ethnic demographics. So I was able to get a sample that not only looked like the city of Chicago, but a sample that allowed me to analyze the data within racial and ethnic groups. So when I went into each classroom, I randomly assigned students to one of 2 textbooks. The textbooks looked exactly the same to the students. However, the content written on the page came from one of 2 history textbooks. So the first textbook, which I used as an example of a traditional American history textbook, was the American Pageant, which is a widely used textbook in many advanced placement U.S. history classes in the United States. And then for the second textbook, I chose a more critical text, a text that was still at the same reading level as the American pageant, and a text that is widely available, and that was Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States. And I selected three historical events for the students to read about. First, the abolitionist movement, to give a moment in history in which Black people in the United States exercised agency. The second topic was Cesar Chavez and the formation of the United Farm Workers of America movement. Again, an example of Latinx agency in the United States. And then finally, resistance to the Chinese Exclusion Act. And what I found is that within the same classrooms, students who read the more critical textbook passage were more likely to say that they would participate in a variety of political activities, not only protesting and demonstrating, but also voting in elections and also in the future volunteering or working on a political campaign. So what I conclude from this research is, you know, the content that we teach about in these courses matters quite a bit. And it's not merely symbolic. A lot of the debates over content that we've seen in the United States, you know, since the Civil War have focused on the symbolic importance of our history. But what I demonstrate in this research is that the content is not merely symbolic. It has real effects on democratic outcomes among young people. So I want you
to testify before the Board of Education. You can tell I come from teachers, because I think you can sort of confirm this for me, because you're the PhD and you're more knowledgeable. This is your area of expertise. My understanding is that when you buy textbooks for schools around the country, there are really two very important places you've got to sell your textbook. One is California and the other is Texas. And they don't buy the same textbooks. In fact, they don't demand the same information. No surprise. And Texas is, I don't know where this American pageant is from. I have to go check it out. But Texas is so conservative and so subtly racist, if not overtly racist, in the kinds of things that they expect in their textbooks, that if you actually read that textbook, you would think that we were living in nirvana, that we had never done anything wrong, that we have empowered African Americans, and it's their fault that they're not successful, and that we did nothing but free them. You know what I mean? So I've always said, and you would know that song, you've got to be taught to hate and fear. You've got to be taught year after year. Well, what you're telling me is that what we have been teaching has been setting up the winners and setting up the losers.
That's absolutely right. So my interest in this topic actually came out of my experiences as a public school teacher in San Antonio, Texas. And I came in.
No idea, everyone. I had no idea. All right, keep going. Okay, this is like unbelievable. All right, keep going.
I came into the classroom in Texas as a 22-year-old. My first year of teaching was right on the eve of the 2012 presidential election. You know, I'm a white guy from Minnesota going into a classroom in Texas, predominantly of young people of color. And I was very excited about this election. I was very excited about the content I was teaching in social studies, which was very much about the election. And my students were kind of looking at me like, who is this guy and why is he so excited about this upcoming election? And to be clear, my students were not politically apathetic. They did not lack political knowledge. They had more sophisticated stances on housing policy, on immigration policy than even I did as a 22-year-old. But what they were telling me by expressing skepticism in my excitement toward the election was this process was not working for them in the way that it had worked for me. And while I grew up finding the stories I learned about in my history textbooks, my social studies textbooks, to be empowering, it's because I saw narratives that looked like my own within those textbooks. And my students did not have that opportunity. And that opportunity was very much structured. And all of a sudden, this was an aha moment for me where I saw these structures emerge within the textbooks that I was teaching to my students. And back to your point, what is remarkable about this is the textbooks that my 10 and 11-year-old students were reading were the exact same textbooks that I read in Minnesota when I was in a social studies classroom in elementary school. And to your point, the state of Texas and California have extreme power over which textbooks ultimately get published. because, you know, those are the states where, you know, large swaths of school-age children are in the United States. So to your point, the state of Texas holds a remarkable amount of influence over the content that ultimately makes it into these textbooks.
Well, you know, it's so interesting because you hear over and over again, okay, what we need to do with the African-American community is we need to make sure that they get access to education. We just may need to make sure that, you know, this is the answer. And of course, nobody says, really, what kind of education? What are we teaching them? Are we teaching them that white people succeed? And maybe you can be like us? You know, I mean, that's how I feel. I always see these stories and they're like, they feel like a weight on my shoulder. So I'm running for governor and I've won the nomination and it's 2 weeks before the election and I'm a chamber of commerce, okay? And this is the first question after I address this big chamber of commerce. Excuse me, lady, have you ever held a job? Okay, I'm running for governor. And the whole room, you can hear this, oh, my father saying, don't get mad, be funny. Don't get mad, be funny. That's in my head, okay? So I looked at the guy and I said, no, I said, actually, I woke up one morning and said, you know, I could make brownies for 78 cents or I could run for governor. I don't know why, but I decided to run for governor. And then I looked at the guy that asked the question and I said, here's what you see. You see a young woman in a short skirt. You probably see an elementary school teacher. Maybe you see a nursing aide. Maybe you see your wife making dinner. And I went through all these things. I said, what you don't see is a lawyer. What you don't see is a developer. What you don't see is a legislator. And what you don't see is a governor. I said, but guess what? You'll get used to it. Okay? That's my mini story of they have had no exposure to women in leadership. They had no exposure to women as CEOs. They had no exposure to women as governors. Well, if you have no exposure to it, you're not necessarily rejecting me because I'm female. You just assume I can't do it. Well, think about your students in Texas. You know, if they don't have any role models, if they don't see their story, if they don't see their successes, and everything is a success that kind of looks like someone from Minnesota with blonde hair and blue eyes, well, then where's my America?
Exactly. Exactly. And throughout my research, I make this exact argument that access alone is necessary, but it's inadequate. There is a lot of discussion, you know, in this content about inclusion, and those conversations are really important. However, I also argue that, you know, it's not enough to just teach young people and young people of color more about Rosa Parks and MLK and even Malcolm X and W.E.B. Du Bois, merely because the ways in which we tell the stories, even of marginalized group members, are oftentimes so godlike that no 10 or 11-year-old is looking up to these people as someone that they're able to emulate. So the focus on collective action and collective agency is really important because it allows people a window into seeing ways in which everyday people also have managed to get involved in the political process and make a difference. And sadly, we may not know the names of those individuals. However, these are truly the people who make a difference and shape our history. So
I think in your article, Matt Nelson, you talk about, you know, the janitors for justice. When they suddenly see someone like them, not someone who, I mean, Barack Obama is a great role model, but how many of us are going to go to Harvard? I mean, let's be honest. How many of us, you know, get to study in Hawaii? You know, how many, I'll be honest with you. He's about as privileged as you can get. And yet, yes, he's African-American, but he's so unrelated to your experience. When you see that your experience can make a difference, and not necessarily because that person becomes famous, but because that person becomes part of a movement, and that movement changes the policy that affects thousands of lives. And without that movement, without that participation, it doesn't happen. In a lot of ways, the story that we're seeing right now of the men and women who've died at the hands of police, a lot of them are stories of very flawed people. They're not gods. They're not PhDs. But passing a $20 phony bill is not a reason to die, okay? It's not a reason for it to have a chokehold of 8 minutes and 46 seconds. I mean, when we begin to realize that the people that took us to our economic knees in 2008 are richer today, nobody did a perp walk, and what they did was steal more than a $20 bill, okay? And we almost need to put those two together and go, so that's a good guy with the cufflinks? And this is a bad guy with a phony $20 bill? I'm sorry. They're both flawed. One, however, is a hell of a lot more flawed because he's sitting on a mountain of cash, all right? But it's an opportunity for us to realize that these individuals have made a difference. They didn't necessarily want to make that difference. They had to die in accomplishing it. In a way, it's their flaws that make it important for people to understand we all deserve a place in this society. We all deserve justice. We all deserve to be treated fairly, you know? And what you saw there was by our failure to treat him fairly. His life now has taken on meaning so that we all can fight for that.
That's right.
It's just amazing. So your dissertation you're going to defend tomorrow. What is the title of your dissertation? I need to get personal in the last 3 minutes. I love what you write and I love what you think and I can't believe you taught in Texas. By the way, I went to St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. So just to make us, there we go. So, I mean, Anyway, oh my God, this is even scarier. Anyway, so what are you defending tomorrow? And is this was what you did in Chicago? Is that your sort of the premise of your dissertation?
Yes. So my dissertation is called Educating for Empowerment, Race, Socialization, and Reimagining Civic Education. And the dissertation is split up over 5 chapters. The early chapters make this argument that increasing access to civic education is insufficient because civic education courses, as we know them now, could be doing more. And then the research that you and I were talking about today is from the third chapter of the dissertation. And then the final chapters focus on teachers more and try to better understand how the attitudes and lived experiences of educators allow them to navigate these institutional hurdles to deliver these really empowering civic learning opportunities, even in the face of school and educational structures that make it really difficult to do so. So there's a lot of teacher agency in there.
Okay, well. let me throw out my last point to you is, let me be a teacher for you. And the teacher for you is, I had a fourth grade class and I was invited in to speak to the fourth grade class and they just finished their math class. So I came in right at the end of math. And I said, oh, good, we're going to do a math problem. So I decided to ask them how they thought we funded public education. And they had just seen some ads on TV about the lottery. And they thought that the lottery was how they funded public education. I said, oh, really? And where did you get this idea? And they showed me television. I'm like, yeah, so you learn. And they went, well, let's do some math on the blackboard. And then I proceeded to talk to them about what the cost of public education was that year. What the cost of education was over the 25 or 30 years that we have been funding public education and how long the lottery has been in existence. So I put all those dollar signs up on the blackboard and I said, so how's that lottery doing in funding public education? This is a fourth grade class. I'm using math. I'm just putting the numbers up, right? No, nothing else. And all of a sudden, a little fourth grader at the back of the room went, they lie. Oh my God. So what I'm saying to you is, education can happen in a fourth grade class using math. And sometimes doing the math and using it as a math problem is as powerful as the history lesson and the civics lesson and the marching in the streets. All I had to do was write 5 numbers on the blackboard and they could see the commas in those huge numbers and the smaller numbers. And I just said, so there must be something else that's paying for education. And you know what it is? It's the house you live in. And is Arnie being political? Maybe. Is Arnie teaching them civics? Yes. But why is this civics so challenged? Because it's fraught with a policy agenda where one group wants to continue to rely on the property tax. You know, Arnie's the antichrist. And Arnie, who wants to get off the property tax because she thinks it just creates the haves and the have-nots in communities, it's essential civics information. I'm just going to throw that out to you, that as we think about civics, we need to think about it in all forms and in all classrooms and with all ages. And on that note, good luck tomorrow. Break a leg, Matt Nelson, my St. Olaf grad, who's now at Northwest. I'm so proud of you. And we will talk again, I'm sure.
Thank you so much.
Pleasure. All right, everyone, this is The Attitude with great producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Ciao. You better think about what you're trying to do to me. Think, let your mind go, let yourself be free. Let's go back, let's go.
mountains.